today's Teisho will be on case 3 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 3 is entitled Gute Raises a Finger. Whenever Gute Osho was asked about Zen, he simply raised his finger. Once a visitor asked Gute's boy attendant, "What does your master teach?" The boy too raised his finger. Hearing of this, Gute cut off the boy's finger with a knife. The boy, screaming with pain, began to run away. Gute called to him, and when he turned around, Gute raised his finger. The boy suddenly became enlightened. When Gute was about to pass away, he said to his assembled monks, "I obtained one-fingered Zen from Tenryu and used it all my life, but still did not exhaust it." When he had finished saying this, he entered into eternal nirvana. Mumon's comment, "The enlightenment of Gute and the boy does not depend on the finger. If you understand this, Gute, Tenryu, and the boy, and you yourself are all run through with one skewer." Mumon's verse, "Gute made a fool of old Tenryu, emancipating the boy with a single slice, just as Kore cleaved Mount Kasan to let the Yellow River run through." Well, I want to thank everybody for coming to practice this morning, to do Zazen. And on Saturday, I think it's a wonderful way to spend a Saturday morning sitting in deep samadhi. Last night, I was listening to the weather report, and as usual, the weather people try so hard to make it sound we're on the edge of doom. A couple people on the Weather Channel were talking about the snow, and it could be could be 1 to 3 inches or more, so they were trying to create anxiety and fear about snow, which is quite a natural occurrence. In that way, they can get more people to watch their program. But it has the effect sometimes of really making people worried. People see news coverage and they think, well, maybe I should just stay in the house. And they're daunted by the prospect of some uncertainty. So in spite of the fact that there was some uncertainty, everybody came to sit this morning. And you might have had uncertainties of other kinds as well. But something inside of you, something in you, made you get up and come here, or made it a pleasure to get up and come here, I hope. And it's worth thinking about what it was that prompted you to come here. In a way, this koan is sort of about that. You know, people are not very, how we shall we say, people are not always very alert or attentive to their own mental states. We tend to live in a cognitive universe, so to speak, which is very limited, very limited. You know, if you imagine, you could imagine consciousness as one thing, right? One thing, consciousness. And this is a way the West has pretty much thought about the mind. You know, if you read philosophers, they talk about the mind, and they talk about reason and on reason. And sometimes they talk about consciousness and unconsciousness. You know, this is a very Western tradition. In the modern world, though, because of like psychology, the study of the mind from a new perspective, people have realized that there isn't really just one form of consciousness. It's not just you're either conscious or you're unconscious. It's a little more complicated than that. And Buddhists also realized that, actually, people in ancient India and ancient China realized long, long ago, many thousands of years ago, that there wasn't just one kind of consciousness, that there are many, many different forms of consciousness. And basically, this was a great discovery that it took thousands of years for the West to catch up with. But people in ancient times, in ancient India and ancient China, realized that something wasn't just true or false because it was a proposition that was true or false. You know, the Greeks said something is either true or false. Its reason says it's true or it's false, period. People in India said, wait a minute. You know, depending on your state of mind, this could be true and it could be false. So sometimes the truth or falsity is not really so simple. It really depends on your state of mind, that in some states of mind something can be true, and in another state of mind something can be false. This is like hugely different from the way the West thinks. The ancient people in China and India were really psychologists. They really had a theory of psychology, which we didn't really have until very recent times. One way to think about Indian and Chinese culture is that they began to investigate consciousness. And they realized that there were many, many different states of consciousness. And not just one. Eventually they came up with this idea that there was like a spectrum of consciousness. Spectrum. They don't use the word spectrum, but they sort of thought that way. So, you know, if you think of the color spectrum in science, you know, you have, on one side you have, I think it's red, starting with red, and you go all the way to indigo. I believe that's right. In the middle there are these other, there's all these different colors from sort of going from light to dark and so on. I don't remember my color spectrum. But anyway, there's a spectrum, right? Or you could imagine it like keys on a piano, right? On one side, there's like the extreme of confusion, right? There's an extreme of confusion. And in Buddhism, we call that samsara. That's like the worst mental state. So I'm sure you've had days like that, right? Where you get up in the morning and you're feeling edgy, and your roommate comes in and just says exactly the wrong thing, and you blow up, right? Maybe you get really mad, and you storm out of the room. Later you think, oh God, why did I do that? You know, but you still don't feel good. You feel sort of maybe tearful or on edge, edgy. Maybe you're pissed off about something. And all day long, it just seems to be like that, right? You know, you seem to be sort of at war with things, you know. So you get in your car and you start driving and you've got to get to class and you look and you realize you didn't fill up your gas tank, you know, so it's almost on empty. And you think, oh, crap, and now I'm going to be late again, you know. So you go to the gas station and you look in your wallet and there's, you know, you really don't have enough money to fill up the tank, or, you know, maybe you have just a dollar. Can you give me a dollar's worth of gas? You know. And the guy looks at you like you're an idiot, and I hope this dollar gets me down to New Brunswick. Okay, then you get to New Brunswick and you get in, there's no parking place because it's Rutgers. You drive around and around and you're waiting for your dollar of gas to run out. Okay, then you finally park. You get to class, the professor gives you a sour look because you're late again, you know. And then you see a girl you like or a boy you like, and you say hello. You give them a wink, and they look at you with a sour look, like you're an idiot, or you feel like you're an idiot. You feel, you know. Okay. So finally, class is over. You get out of class. You run back to your car, and there's a big fat ticket on it. It's like welcome to, and the ticket says welcome to Rutgers, right? And then you know, it just goes a whole day like that. You know, sometimes you go to bed at night and you think, oh, thank God this day is over. Right? Thank God this day is over. You know, what a crappy day. Okay. Or, you know, it's a day like, something terrible happens to you. You have an auto accident, you know. And you just, so there are days when people just wish they weren't alive, right? You know, there are such days, you know. And that's, the Buddhist word for that is samsara. You know, if you visualize the spectrum of consciousness, on one end is samsara. And samsara is characterized by almost complete disconnection from everything around you. It's characterized by this feeling of being disconnected or at war with the world around you. And when you're in a state of disconnection, you're not just usually unhappy, but you're usually rather paranoid and fearful as well. You know, so it's not just disconnection, but it's also like maximum distrust. So, you know, usually when you're in that state, you worry, right? You worry, you think, you know, what's going to happen? You know, I've got to pay these bills. I don't know where the money's coming from. You lie down in bed at night and you toss and turn. And you just realize, you know, this is all out of control. Where is my life going? You know, I'm just a little speck of dust in the universe. I have nobody listens to me. You know, I have no, what are my chances of happiness? What are my, you know, I mean, we've all been there, right? We all, I mean, everybody has been there, you know. This will never work out, you know, I'll never be happy, you know, she would never like me, you know, he would never like me, you know, so this is samsara, we've all been there, right, you know, we've all been there, you know, and so if you visualize the spectrum, one end is samsara, which is maximum disconnection, and then if you go to the other end of the spectrum, you know, the other end of the spectrum is like this feeling you sometimes have where you just think everything is unfolding as it has to unfold, and it's all sort of like magically unfolding. You know, it's all magically occurring in this beautiful way. So, you know, you're late, you get up one day, and you feel like $1 million. You've got to go to your lecture, and you remember what it is, and you're excited to be going. You thank God I got into that course. I love this subject, you know. You jump into your car, it starts right up, no traffic. You get down to New Brunswick, right in front of the class, you know, there's a parking place, right there. You jump out, you see a beautiful girl or this handsome guy, hello, and they go, hi, how are you? Oh my God, you know, pinch me. You go into class, you know, you realize this is fascinating. Maybe this is what I want to do with my life. You see the professor afterwards and you say, that was wonderful. And the professor says, oh, you're interested? Come and see me. Come to my office. We'll chat about it, you know. You go out of the classroom at the end of class and there's the girl is waiting and you say, would you like to go to lunch tomorrow? Sure, let's meet for lunch. You know, you get home and your refund check is from the federal government has arrived, you know. So you can afford lunch. You think, God, life is great. You know, the sun is shining, buds are on the trees. You feel like, I am so happy to be alive. You know, this is like, that's a nirvana. That's nirvana. When people imagine nirvana, they imagine it as like heaven. Right, but the Buddha really didn't mean it in that sense. He meant that when you are free from clinging and attachment, and you're in a condition of trust with the world, you know, you're working with events. This is nirvana. And so consciousness is like a spectrum, or like the keys of a piano. And on one side is samsara, which is, you know, a horrible place to be. And we've all been there, you know, and we'll all be there again. You know, it's just the truth. We'll all be there again. But on the other hand, there's this other condition of being, which is at the opposite end, which is nirvana. And this is where, samsara is maximum disconnection and distrust. And nirvana is maximum connection and trust. See? So, from the Buddhist standpoint, a bodhisattva, a fully developed bodhisattva, is a being, or a Buddha, is a being who totally trusts the universe. See, and totally trusts the universe. That would be a Buddha or a bodhisattva, a fully realized bodhisattva. Somebody who has total trust in the universe. And that would be a good thing. Because from the standpoint of Buddhism, this nirvana and samsara are not really objective conditions. So in my little story, in one case, I said, you know, you get in the car and you don't have enough gas, and there's no parking place, and those are all objective conditions. But from the Buddhist standpoint, actually, your being in nirvana or samsara doesn't depend on objective conditions. You think it does, but it doesn't. Right? So the bodhisattva or the Buddha is somebody who gets up and jumps into the car and runs out of gas on the way to class and pushes the car to the gas station, something like that. Maybe it's a small car. Talks the guy into a gallon of gas or something like that and gets to class late and goes to see the professor and says, you know, my car broke down and so on, you know. But all this throughout the whole thing still has this happy outlook, still has this trusting mind and happy mind, bright mind. Even in all of this, see, that would be what we're striving for. So it's really state of mind, you know. If you're in a deep samsara, even good things can be bad, can be made to appear bad, right? And I'm sure that's happened to you. I'm sure you went on a trip when you were a kid. And you were in some kind of inner turmoil, and everybody went to the beach, and you look around, and everybody's happy at the beach except you. Right? And you feel like you're a million miles away from everybody else. You're alone with your misery. Right? And that's a samsara. And on the other hand, there are people who, you know, objectively speaking, shouldn't be happy, but they are. You know? And I have met many such people in my life. You know, people who are just really very happy in spite of everything, you know. I've met people like that who haven't done any meditation too, but they're somehow able to be trusting and fully present. And so they're in a kind of nirvana mind all the time, you know, or not all the time, but often, you know. I mean, we have a kind of baseline consciousness, if you think about it. You know, there's the two extremes. There's samsara and nirvana. And then, you know, most human beings are hopefully somewhere in between, right? And our baseline may be a little closer to the nirvana side, and it may be a little closer to the samsara side. And in any particular day, you're not entirely in samsara and you're not entirely in nirvana, right? You have your nirvana moments and then you have your samsara moments. So your consciousness is sort of going up and down the spectrum. You know, so for a minute you're in nirvana, for half an hour you're in nirvana, and then you sort of plunge back into samsara, and then you come back to nirvana, and then you're sort of middle of the road for most of the day, you know, something like that would be a normal human day. You know, so, a meditation practice is based on this idea that consciousness is multiple. There are multiple forms of consciousness. And that we we have the power to transform our minds. And basically, we don't have to be imprisoned by our circumstances. You know, generally speaking, we are prisoners of our circumstances, and that includes like our mental history. You know, so basically, we've all had events in our lives that stick with us. You know, when Buddhists talk about karma, they're talking about things that have left they're like psychological habits or default positions that we return to, you know. In my home, my parents got divorced when I was starting college. I went to college a little early, so I was 17, 16. My parents got divorced, and I moved away. I remember, going to college, and I had a friend in college, Larry Sullivan, whom I've talked about. I go hiking with him a lot. And I went to his house, and I was so surprised that everybody spoke so quietly. Because in my house, everybody spoke very loudly, and it was like there was a little bit of, there was a fair amount of screaming sometimes. Right? So it was like, aren't you guys going to start screaming? You know, isn't it the end of the world yet? You know, why aren't you hysterical yet? You know? When my sister married her husband Barney, and he's a very nice man, she was in her usual mode, and he said, you know, Laura, you don't have to scream. You know, it's okay. You know, and I notice when I go to visit, you know, she's really changed, you know. But there's a default position where you're fighting for your life and you have to be heard and nobody's listening to you, so you elevate your voice, right? And it's something you do unconsciously, but it's sort of like the pattern. It was the pattern in our family. Everybody was like that. Everybody was sort of on the edge of nervous breakdown all the time. So when I went to Larry Sullivan's house and everybody was so calm, you know, I just, what is this? You know, but we don't usually notice our own habits, of course, but we have them, right? We develop these styles of being, habits, styles. You grow up, maybe everybody in your home is always like, it's always like a crisis. In my home, my mother used to say, my mother was just always worn out from coping with one crisis after another. And I loved my mother very much, and she had many courageous aspects to her personality. But she was always like on the edge of her seat. You know, it just seemed like everything was a crisis. And she used to say, if it's not one thing, it's another. I love that saying because it's true. You know, if it's not one thing, it's another. But for her, it was like always like a crisis coming and then a crisis averted. And then a crisis coming and a, you know, disaster coming, disaster averted. You know, that was just how, you know, I picked that up from my mother. You know, that was how her family another way to say crisis averted, disaster averted, is to say everything worked out okay, right? But that's the positive. That would be the positive side. It's like disaster is the baseline for certain minds, right? It's like a disaster is what's likely to happen, you know, unless we dodge the bullet this time. That was sort of like the baseline. So those are mental habits, right, that we pick up in life. And we don't know them, but we carry them. We carry them through life, you know. And so maybe you came from a home that was very sunny and optimistic, and so people assume, in my wife's family, as a matter of fact, there's always this assumption that everything was going to be fine. No, don't worry, it'll all work out. Not be worrying. No, it'll be fine. You can't be. Really? It'll be fine? You know? So we have these characteristics that we unconsciously take from growing up and from our life experiences, and they establish sort of a baseline. Traditionally, you know, we don't really, in the West, in our culture, we haven't really had any way to control our baseline, you know. So we just go through life and we are screaming a lot or nervous a lot or fearful a lot. And, you know, we have developed strategies, you know, basically alcohol, for coping with stress, television and so on. But the good thing about meditation is that it gives you tools for actually like transforming your consciousness. So you can actually change your baseline consciousness. It can be done. And so you might think about meditation as like it is breaking out of the habit of falling into certain familiar mental states. You know, we don't occupy the whole spectrum usually from nirvana to samsara. You know, we tend to hang around a certain wavelengths or certain frequencies a lot. Our baseline tends to be, you know, a little bit hysterical, a little bit angry, you know, and meditation, Zen is all about saying, look, you can change your baseline, you know, you can change those, you don't have to just keep getting up anxious and angry, going through life and anxious and angry, you know, and so on. You can change that, you know, or fearful and depressed, you know, you can change that. And so, you know, when we sit down on the cushion, one way to think about what we're doing is that we're actually sort of like watching the breath, and we're going through different states of mind, you know. Actually, it's like you're flipping up and down the spectrum, you know. You're going up and down the keys of the piano. And a lot of the keys are unfamiliar. A lot of the wavelengths are unfamiliar. And, you know, sometimes you're just snoozing on the cushion, sometimes you're just in pain. But, you know, usually you're stuck in one of your mental states, you know. So you sit down on the cushion and you start worrying. Or you sit down on the cushion and you think about something that somebody said and you get mad, you know. Or you're feeling mad at yourself or something, you know. These are like your familiar wavelengths, you know. But you keep coming back to the breath. If you keep watching the breath, little by little, what tends to happen is that you begin to slip out of your familiar wavelengths, you know, and you start moving up the spectrum towards nirvana, you know, generally speaking. And, you know, you might suddenly be sitting on the cushion in your usual state of anxiety or your usual state of fear or your usual state of annoyance or whatever. And all of a sudden, you know, you're in this state that you might not consciously recognize, but as different, but you suddenly feel better, you know? You suddenly feel happy. And maybe there's this sense of connectedness or safety and well-being. And it might not happen on the cushion, it might happen off the cushion. You know, you get off the cushion and you go back to your car and you suddenly notice, gee, I feel really good. You know, I feel, where's the anxiety? You know, where's my familiar anxiety? It seems to be gone, you know. That happens all the time. And so, you know, we're sort of like going up and down the spectrum when we meditate. And sometimes we stumble into these states of mind that are like different states of, altered states of consciousness, you know. And eventually you realize that some of these states of consciousness are really quite wonderful. You can't really just order yourself to go. You know, when you meditate, it's a little bit like working with a radio that has a dial on it Basically, you can't read the numbers on the on the dial anymore, right? So you have to sit there and you have to listen carefully and turn the knob, you know. And you're going through all these different stations. You know, you get, you know, WBAI, and you get, you know, something else, and you get, you know, rock, K-Rock, and then you get, you know, Rush Limbaugh, and you quickly turn by that. And finally, you get to this this other channel, you know, where you suddenly feel very safe, deeply connected, well-being, and so on. You know, next time you sit down at the radio, you still have to grope for the channel. You know, you don't know where it is, and you go through this, you go through that, but eventually, with some regularity, you'll get into this state we call samadhi. Samadhi. And this morning on the cushion in my last sit, I was like in deep samadhi. And it's just this incredibly deep, it's like you feel like you're in something, you're connected to something. There's a very powerful sense of well-being. Actually, you can feel very motionless, like you can feel absolutely motionless, absolutely solid, or you can feel like you're floating. Different people experience samadhi in different ways. But sometimes it can feel like your hands or your face have disappeared, you know. Normally, when we sit on the cushion, we're a little bit anxious, a little bit agitated. You can feel, you know, you feel like sometimes you might feel like you need to get off the cushion. I'm on the cushion, but I need to get off. You know? Impatient. That's just your normal wavelength. But every once in a while, if you keep watching the breath, you'll fall into this state where suddenly there seems to be no time, or time seems irrelevant, and you might feel solidly planted, or you might feel like you're floating, you know, or empty, you know, your hands have disappeared. The physical features, the way you experience your body when you're in samadhi is not really terribly important, but you experience the moment very differently in ordinary consciousness. There's this, and the hallmark of it is that you feel your boundaries are down. You could say your boundaries are down. Your defenses are down because you feel at ease, or you feel a kind of peacefulness. Normally, we don't feel at ease, you know, in the world. We feel anxious and a little bit alienated or isolated. And in samadhi, we feel safe at home and at ease. And this might not happen to you right on the cushion. You might get off the cushion and you finally stretch your legs and think, oh, my poor legs, you know. But then you suddenly go to the bathroom and as you're walking down the bathroom, you feel buoyant, you know, and safe. It's like home. I'm home. It's a wonderful feeling. Samadhi is really great. And when people can enter into samadhi, they're really at stage one of Zen practice. You know, being able to get to this place, which is in the Shin Shin Ming, in the verses on the heart mind, is called the unified mind in accord with the way. And in Buddhist philosophy, this is called non-dualistic awareness. It's a little bit fancy term. But normally, you know, normally, we don't want to be here. Yeah? You know, normally we want to be anywhere but here, and anyone but me. I can remember I took this terrible, terrible course in college. I almost got straight A's in college, I'm proud to say. But I almost failed. I got a D in British history. And I would go to this class, and it was so boring, I couldn't stand it. The professor was so boring. And people would say, oh, Professor Graebner, he's brilliant, you know. And I just could not focus my mind, and it was so. I literally would get like I would take these quizzes and I would bomb them, and I would try to read the book, and it was just so boring. I don't know what it was about British history, but I just couldn't stand it. And I should have dropped the course, you know, really early on, but I didn't, and I stuck through, and I think I got a D. It was my only bad grade. And I would sit in that class and just think, I can't believe I'm here. You know, I hate this place, you know. So this is like a typical situation, right? I'm here, but I don't want to be here. This is a divided mind. And I would sit in class and I would watch Professor Graebner's mouth move, but I just couldn't take it in, right? And so I didn't respond constructively. I became even more phobic about the course, you know, and instead of trying to find a way into the material, I sort of like decided that this material was my enemy and so on. You know? So I intensified my sense of alienation from the course. And I could have gone to see the professor. I wouldn't have asked him why his course was so boring, but I could have asked why I was having so much trouble understanding British history. You know, why is this so hard? So anyway, you know, being here but not wanting to be here is very human. It's all humans spend a lot of time in that condition. That's divided mind. And even when we're not in history class, British history, you know, we're walking along the street, we're sort of here in a conditional way. It's like we're here but we're not here. I'm alive but I'm not alive. You know, I'm here under certain conditions. And with certain reservations all the time. That's a normal, unhealthy mind, right? That's the mind not unified and not in accord with the way. But when we sit down on the cushion and we begin to enter into this unified state, we feel better. We feel happy and trusting and connected. And this is like a mentally healthy state, you know? And at first, when you meditate, you fall into that state by accident. But eventually, you'll get there with more regularity. It won't happen every time, and it won't happen with the same depth every time. But generally speaking, with practice, you can enter into a kind of moderate state of samadhi pretty easily. You know, you sit down on the cushion. After about 10 minutes, you begin to feel more relaxed, more calm. You know, you're viewing your thoughts, but they're not gripping you and inspiring terror or anxiety. Your mind is calm. You might even doze a little bit. That's not a crime. You know, it's not the best thing. But your anxiety level is lower, and you're aware, and you might begin to even feel very good. You know, that would be a good sit sometime. So you know, when we're doing Zen, we're meditating. We're going up and down the spectrum. We're trying to get out of our habitual states, and we're entering this state of, sometimes we enter by accident, this state of the unified mind in accord with the way, this unified mind. And when you practice meditation, you get there more often. This is why people continue to meditate, you know, because they get to samadhi enough so they sort of intuitively understand what this is about. And they feel better. They might even hate sitting, but they still do it because it puts them in a better place. That's not so uncommon. As some people love to sit, and that's a very lucky break. I myself actually enjoy this quite a bit, but the first 10 years were difficult. After that, I always say, the first 10 years are the hardest. So, Gute is this guy who has been practicing Zen for a long time. And he is able to be in a kind of samadhi state off the cushion as well as on the cushion. This is quite an advanced practitioner. You know, so you know, he's basically in, you know, the more time you spend in samadhi, the easier it is to be in samadhi on the cushion and off the cushion. And basically, you know, you'll be off the cushion and you'll suddenly realize that you're just responding to events without any powerful revulsion or anxiety. You might even sometimes feel that things are unfolding in this natural way, this experience of the flow experience, right? Where you just feel like everything's unfolding and you're working with it. You're in the groove. You're in the groove. And it doesn't necessarily mean that everything you do is turning out successfully. But, you know, sometimes you sit down and you do your work and you're in the groove, or you're doing your, you're at home and you know, everything's going, you feel this sense of coherence or consistency. It's like self and world are operating together, you know, in like a kind of mutual unfolding, you know. And this flow experience, you know, is wonderful, right? It's beautiful, and it takes you know, a lot of practice. You know, some people just pick the thing in life that gives them this flow experience. So, you know, I think scientists have had that flow experience in science, and they pick science because when they're in the lab, they have that wonderful feeling, you know. And I think painters and artists, you know, they get that when they're working with their paints. You know, I think if you like to be a salesperson, you know, some people just love. My wife is a salesperson. You know, she works in a bookstore, and she loves people. She loves that job. You know, she enjoys the company of her customers, and she's had customers for 18 years who come into her store, and they buy books. She's really not trying to sell them books. She's just happy to see them, and she'll chat about books with them, and she's interested in books, and they'll wind up buying a bunch of books because they enjoy her company. That, you know, so a salesperson is somebody who likes people. A good salesperson, I think. You know, and I think my wife gets a samadhi experience from that. You know, but Gute is somebody who's in samadhi a lot. You know, and so when people when anything happens, you know, he represents his samadhi state with his finger. So somebody will come to Gute, and they'll you know, maybe somebody comes to Gute and says, Gute, you know, my house is underwater. You know, I bought the house at the top of the market, and now it's worth $100,000 less than it was. What'll I do? You know, I can't renegotiate my mortgage. You know, what should I do? And Gute just holds up his finger. And, you know, people might be teed off about this, might think, well, that's no help. But, you know, apparently it works. You know, people realize, they look at that finger and think, okay, I know that suddenly their minds become calmer and they feel assured, reassured that things are going to work out, you know. And so, you know, Gute becomes sort of like a famous teacher because people come with their distress, you know, and he just holds up his finger, and he's so authoritative in his personality that they suddenly feel calmer. You know, there are such people around. You know, Genki Roshi was like that. I could be very anxious, and I would go in to see him, and I instantly felt calmer. You know, I just instantly felt trust in his presence. I felt trust in life in his presence. You know, and the Dalai Lama has that effect. People go to see the Dalai Lama, and they're always just, they go in and they leave laughing. He leaves them laughing, you know. They actually leave with this sense of joy at being alive. So some people are like that, you know. Some teachers are like that. They can really inspire, you know. Genki could inspire like this. I'd be really worried and anxious, and then I'd go in and see him, and I'd feel so calm, so grounded, you know. And just sitting next to him was a remarkable experience because he was just so grounded, you know. And he had made a practice of being grounded, you know. He would enter samadhi, just like a Gute. You know, so things didn't throw him or rattle him. He would ground himself in the moment. He'd just bring his mind right back to the moment and into samadhi with the moment. You know, just be in the moment. And when you are in the moment, your anxieties go away. They really do. You know, anxiety is caused by, repeating the past mental state. And it's also caused by trying to control the future, right? Anxiety is largely a product of having projections and life isn't filling your ideals, you know. But Genki, you know, would really just ground you right in the moment. He'd bring you right back to the moment. And it was really comforting. And the Dalai Lama does that in a different way, you know. But Gute would too. He'd hold up his finger and people would just suddenly feel calm. Like, okay, you know, I thought the world was falling apart, but now I see it's not. It all comes together right here in this moment. Right here in your finger. And I feel so much better. Thank you. So anyway, Gute knew how to enter deep samadhi, how to ground himself. That feeling you get on the cushion, where you suddenly feel safe and connected and grounded, you know, that's samadhi. And Gute could feel that. He was there a lot of the time. He knew how to ground himself in the moment quickly. And that was from practice. You know? And so people would see him, and he would always hold up his finger, and they'd go away and go, "Oh, that Gute, I feel so much better," you know. Gute had an attendant, a student, his Inji, his personal attendant, who would, you know, watch Gute do Dokusan. You know, people would come in to see Gute for a private interview, and maybe the little student was spying on them, looking through the curtain, you know, watching Gute, and somebody would go, "Oh, Gute, you know, I'm losing my business, you know, what'll I do?" And he'd hold up his, "Oh, thank you. I feel so much better. I forgot that I could ground myself in the moment." So the student watched this, and then he would go out, he would do shopping and things for the temple, and people would ask the student a question. You know, they'd say, "Well, you know, what do you think about the economy?" And the kid would just hold up his finger, and they'd go, "Oh, this, what a wise little kid, you know. You're so wise, you know." And so in the town, the kid got a reputation for being very wise because he would hold up his finger too. But he really didn't know how to enter samadhi. He was just full of baloney. So in the story, somebody must have come to Gute and said, "Oh, Gute, your student is so amazingly wise." And Gute would have said, "Huh? What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, when everybody asks him a question, he just holds up his finger." Hmm. So anyway, he calls the student in and asks him a question. The kid holds up his finger, and Gute takes out a knife and cuts his finger off. And the student is, of course, upset. This is a fiction, of course, please understand. And he looks at the stump where his finger was, and Gute calls him. And how does it go exactly? The details are... Gute cut off the boy's finger with a knife. The boy, screaming with pain, began to run away. Gute called him, and when he turned around, Gute raised his finger. The boy suddenly became enlightened. So Gute says, look, there really is a state of mind which is imperturbable. Ground yourself in the moment. And he does, in that he's in great distress, right, for all kinds of reasons. He's in pain, physical pain. He's been exposed as the phony baloney he is, you know, the little pretender that he is. And many other things have happened that make the moment distressing for him. And so he's really like in great psychological distress as well as physical pain. And Gute holds up his finger, and the boy's mind immediately becomes calm. He says, "Ah, I understand." Now, you know, we can imagine that calm is totally inaccessible, especially when we're in samsara. We are totally alienated, and we feel that there's no hope, you know, and so on and so on. But every time you sit down on the cushion, you're expressing confidence in your samadhi mind. You know, just coming here is already, you already have samadhi mind. You know, samadhi mind brought you here this morning. It made you get up. It made you wake up at 5:30 and drive all the way over here in the snow, you know. You have this mind which is imperturbable and which is taking care of you day and night. And really, truly, you have a mind which is your best friend, and it's watching out for you, and it loves you and cares for you. And it's grounding you all the time, even when you feel ungrounded. So we're all quite lucky to be alive. And, samsara is really an illusion. And nirvana is really true, you know, really true. So it's a lucky world to be in. Whenever Gute Osho was asked about Zen, he simply raised his finger. Once a visitor asked Gute's boy attendant, "What does your master teach?" The boy too raised his finger. Hearing this, Gute cut off the boy's finger with a knife. The boy, screaming with pain, began to run away. Gute called him, and when he turned around, Gute raised his finger. The boy suddenly grounded himself in samadhi. When Gute was about to pass away, he said to his assembled monks, "I learned how to ground myself in samadhi from Tenryu, and did it all my life, and it never failed me. I never exhausted it." When he finished saying this, he entered into eternal nirvana. Well, he was already in eternal nirvana. Momon's comment: the enlightenment of Gute and of the boy does not depend on the finger. Right? We know that. It's on samadhi. If you understand this, it's not on the circumstances, it's on the consciousness. If you understand this, Tenryu, Gute, and the boy, and you yourself are all run through with one skewer. You know, it's all, your mind is all, you know, in one of the great sutras of the Mahayana, describes enlightenment. It says, in enlightened mind, every experience has one taste. One taste. And what it means is that you're always in this deeply grounded, connected state. When every experience takes you back to this place, one taste mind. That's what they mean, you're all run through with one skewer. Wherever you are, you can ground yourself. And you're learning how to do this on the cushion, and then you can do it off the cushion. You can always do it. Just remember that. Mumon's verse. Gute made a fool of old Tenryu, emancipating the boy with a single slice, just as Kyore cleaved Mount Kasan to let the Yellow River run through. So he cut the boy's finger off, but it was really an act of, please don't do it, but it was really an act of compassion. He broke a barrier inside the boy and allowed this beautiful life energy to flow through in an unobstructed way, like the Yellow River flowing through the mountain passes.